Matt Segundo here, and this is part two of our interview with David Rakoff. We pondered splitting this into three parts, but since this is the last show of 2007, the producers could only afford one more show instead of two. So if it's a bit longer than the norm, it's because we're cheapskates.
What type of journalist would that be, then? I mean, if we're going to go into subtext on him, is there...
A first-person journalist, I guess. A journalist who is... I don't know, you know, I'm very indulged. I am allowed to be at least 50% of the story, which is a weird thing to do. And I should learn how to do a little bit less of that, simply because I think that it's a good set of tools to have. I think all of them are good sets of tools to have. Because of that, because I am allowed to be 50% of the story, I've been tremendously careful from day one. I was tremendously careful about what I revealed and what I didn't reveal. You know,
yeah.
No one knows about my family. No one knows about my love life. No one, you know, it's a very controlled revelation. I'm not a memoirist, for example. Weirdly enough, I've been working on pieces that are a little more personal right now, which has been odd to do. But yeah, I'm both in the story and not of the story.
But I'm wondering if there's a certain risk that you have to confess something if you are 50% of the story. I mean, that has got to be a terrible bridge to walk if you really don't want to reveal things about yourself.
Yes, but I don't feel, you know, I'm sure the day will come when, like, Gypsy Rose Lee, who made a career of not revealing anything and eventually found her, you know, star power fading and, you know, finally took it all off, and by that point nobody cared. There might come a time when I do have to do that, but it's not that difficult to say, not going to do this, not going to talk about this, not going to talk about that. Invariably, whatever I reveal in stories are either in direct response to what's going on, or they're just a kind of a return to a homeostatic kind of despair that suffuses most everything that I do or observe. You know, almost invariably, the insights that I come to are somewhat melancholic, vaguely cranky. You know, it's not, I'm not claiming to pull a different animal out of my hat each time. It's a rabbit each time.
Yeah.
But I'm the one living in my brain. You know, it would be exhausting to change the essential suchness of myself with each story. I am still the same guy observing it.
I'm wondering, though, for personal stories like revealing your days working in publishing or working in an ice cream parlor in Toronto, whether you have contacted some of these people to say, hey, is it okay if I write about you? Or have you just lost touch of them? And this may be in your own small way, your effort to kind of reclaim this memory we were talking about.
Oh, that. Well, you know, those particular stories strike me as being both about the particular, and it is hoped, about some sort of larger thing. The thing about working in publishing as a younger person was, to the best of my recollection, I'm trying to remember it now, and I'm trying to remember how it even ends. But to the best of my recollection, my hope was for that piece was to somehow look at that period of time in one's 20s, if one comes from, you know, if one were to acknowledge the privilege of having been able to go to college and whatever, that sort of outsized sense of entitlement that one has when it is bumps up against the harsh reality of a world where one isn't, in fact, the center of the narrative. And sort of not really blaming the folks who might not have placed you first and foremost in their thoughts, because everybody has a job to do, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Similarly, the ice cream story was about, I hope, the kind of blank surprise and frying pan to the face astonishment that is the circumstances of life that can reduce one to such an extent that one is, you know, working in an ice cream parlor when one had been friends with the king of Greece,
yeah.
You know. And so the hope is that those two are sort of, yeah, they're personal stories, but one hopes that they're actually closer to what Anne Fadiman reconstructed the term familiar essays, you know, that they somehow go somewhere larger and universal. In terms of contacting those two people, I don't know where they are. They hightailed it out of Toronto, and there was, you know, a police, a sheriff's department sticker on the door or something. I mean, they really were refugees in every sense of the word. The folks in publishing, I never contacted them before I wrote. I mean, they've all read it, to the best of my knowledge, because publishing's a very small town. I never contacted them or asked permission, because my feeling was that even those folks who are ostensibly guilty of crimes against the young fellow in those stories are exonerated and absolved. I mean, I feel like I even say the high crime in the story, I mean, I should mention, is that, you know, I was an assistant, not a secretary, and on National Secretary's Day, no, rather on my birthday, I got a card that referred to me as a secretary and not an assistant. At that time in my life, that seemed like a huge infraction, like such an abridgment of who I was and such an incredibly callous thing. When in fact, and I hope that I get this in the story, the impulse behind it was so kind and so grateful and so sweet and so actually seeing me for who and what I was, that I hope that I let the person off the hook.
Yeah.
And I hope that comes through.
Well, not just that, but also I would argue that it shows this youthful folly about being concerned with distinguished titles or lack of distinguished
titles.
That's
exactly
it. When in fact, it's really just about being yourself, you know?
Completely. It's completely useless, these distinctions. And it's somehow, you know, it's just... I'm rendered inarticulate because I don't really... because I'm sitting here trying to remember. And of course, now I remember the ending of the story. Yeah, the hope is that somehow... I haven't sold other people out. Mm-hmm. And maybe I'm fooling myself, but I don't think that I have sold those folks out. There's a piece that I wrote in the first book about going on a Buddhist retreat led by Steven Seagal.
Yeah.
And I do fear that I did use one of the other attendees, pseudonymous though she was rendered, as a little bit of comic fodder. Even though all I do is report, it does feel a little cheap to me.
But one might also argue that you're simply telling the truth as you experienced it at that time, and that to restrain yourself from revealing this human foible would not have been doing justice to the piece.
No, you're right. And ultimately, again, ultimately the hope there is that... is that I acknowledge the huge cosmic fear that these people feel in the face of the world, particularly in this particular case, a world that has ruled them out of favor for being over 35, female and unmarried. Yeah. And there's that hope that I can, that I've done that, that I've done justice to that, and that I've honored that really raw deal that they've been getting. But I still feel like just because I was there and just because I was telling the truth doesn't necessarily mean that what they had thought of as a private interchange needs to be reported, even though I've changed their names.
But you're also assuming, as we all do as humans, that what we do is really that big of a deal, where you might find some big deal calumnious nature to this incident, they may laugh off. I mean, you're placing this kind of judgment that from them. You're really trying to sort of pre-think what they're going to actually think about you. So I guess what I mean is, how do you get over this hang-up for other essays that you're
writing? I don't get over it. That's what makes me kind of a bad reporter. I'm not comfortable, in general, but I'm not comfortable taking someone's story. If someone gives me their story, that strikes me as an act of trust. Unless they're a public figure or a hate monger. Mm. Do you know? Unless I've called someone up and said, I am interviewing you. I'm a journalist. This is what we're doing. And if they say something into my tape recorder, fine. Fair game. If they're an elected public official, fair game. Public figure, similarly. I hope that I've been fairly careful in not selling someone out, not firing off unearned salvos like certain media-based websites do now, you know, that kind of stuff. I don't want to be one of those. I keep on going back to it, but I don't want to be one of those 23-year-olds, you know, who then grow up to be the editor of Vanity Fair, you know.
And who long for what they're really attacking.
Precisely. You know, there's sort of that aspect, which makes me uncomfortable. But yeah, I'm not... I think that even in this day and age of disappearing privacy and constant scrutiny and reality television, I do think that people who do not work in the media, print, television, or otherwise, really understand what it's like to be scrutinized in that way. And I think that one has to be very respectful and mindful of that. I did an obituary. The Times Magazine does a thing at the end of each year called The Lives They Lived. And years ago, I did an obituary of Little Edie Beale, who was the star of Grey Gardens, the documentary by the Maisels brothers. And I was deeply connected to the movie, and I was deeply touched by her always whenever I saw the movie. And I wrote this essay, and I think at one point I talked about the documentary as having been intrusive. I got a call from Albert Maisels, who said that, you know, I really liked the piece. I thought you really captured something. It was really nicely written and all that. And the sort of sense of charity that you felt towards Edie, I felt as well. But I really take exception to your use of the term intrusive. And I didn't say, I mean, we talked for a long time. We talked for about half an hour.
Over-intrusive, pretty.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. We talked for like half an hour, but I didn't want to say like, dude, you know, it was totally intrusive. You know what I mean? It's like, come on.
Yeah.
But we finally came to a conclusion where I finally said, oh, wait a sec. Your feeling is if someone agrees to be in your camera's view, you deserve to tell their story. Like, you deserve the access. And whatever you do with it is okay. And he essentially said, yeah. And I said, well, that's where we differ. Mm. I just don't feel that way. I still feel, you know... Children will respond to the thicker vocal cords and consequent deeper voice of adults and do most anything that adults will tell them to do.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean then that you take their candy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That is the trust. In the same way, you know, you can't just because you have a notebook or just because you can say you come from the New York Times or just because you seem well-spoken... These are tricks. These are ways that you have mesmerized an easily gulled crowd. You then don't sell them snake oil. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I kind of take that a little bit seriously, even as I make jokes about folks, you know. But I try not to make jokes about anybody who hasn't had the privileges that I've had or that whatever potential reader I've had.
Your code is more towards those who are in a position of entitlement. They are the ones who...
Oh, entitlement is a big bugbear for me. Yeah.
Yeah. That's generally my sort of MO as well for these sorts of matters.
Yeah, exactly. I'll go after someone who exhibits a sense of disproportionate entitlement.
Yeah.
Or, you know, the right wing homophobe who, when I interviewed him about the Log Cabin Republicans, because they were so desperate to be part of the Log Cabin, to be part of the Republican Party. And he was just, you know, a complete right-wing hate monger. I mean, just an absolutely hateful individual, a guy named Robert Knight from, like, I think the Family and Culture Institute. And he's the one who said to me when I said, you know, you can get HIV from straight sex. And he's the one who said to me, the vagina can take a lot of punishment. And I thought, you know, you know something? You're a hateful man. You're advancing the cause of hate and intolerance. And you said that into my tape recorder, and I have absolutely no problem exposing you for having just laid that egg.
But that's true, but I'm actually going to slightly disagree with you about this character. Now, granted, I did not meet this gentleman, but I actually felt rather sorry for him. I actually felt a certain empathy. Here's this guy who is desperately trying to belong to an establishment party while also trying to stick to his innate orientation. His
name but this one, no, this guy wasn't a gay Republican himself.
Oh,
this
he was the other guy. He was the other guy. I'm sorry. Okay.
Oh, no. Yeah, I mean, Patrick Guerrero.
Yeah, that's...
Oh, no, I felt nothing but you know, I was just like, dude, you know, he's so... I think I even say at the end, is like, I said to him, I have this theory, dream about you, which is that, you know, Patrick is so nice and smart and committed.
Mm-hmm.
10 years from now, he's not going to be a Republican.
Yeah.
You know, the hope is that, you know, I can change him, which, you know, people have been thinking about gay guys forever.
Yeah.
No, him I had total empathy for. And in fact, he's not with the Log Cabin Republicans anymore.
Interesting.
He's gone to some sort of larger nonpartisan, I think, LGBT organization. I'm not sure. We have no contact, not surprisingly. I don't think that they were, I don't know. I don't know.
Do you regret something like that, that you don't have contact with this guy? Or? Because no, we're talking yeah. about this situation, you know?
Not particularly. I don't think that I sold them out. Did my own political views eventually assert themselves? Undoubtedly, and in quite a forceful way, where I talk about how I think that they're Republican for fiscal reasons. I don't think that the Republicans do make us safer from terrorism. I mean, all the old things. I don't think that smaller government is a good thing. I'm not a fan of smaller government. I like a government that takes care of people. I like socialized medicine, which requires government control, you know. So I also think that they're lying, you know, as many people have said, we're a socialist society for the upper echelons and a capitalist society for the lower echelons. You know, the CEOs who get, you know, tax abatements and free rides are completely the beneficiaries of a largely socialized system. So no, I was fairly forceful in thinking that they were acting like the Republican Party was like a cargo cult. They were going to just wait for everything to come raining from the sky, you know, refrigerators and tax cuts. But I don't think I sold him out. I don't think I said anything, you know, that wasn't, I don't think I said anything gratuitous or unearned. But that said, I can't imagine that he was super happy with the piece.
Yeah. Do you find that injecting yourself in a self-deprecatory tone actually helps you to
soften that sort
to
of
soften
stuff?
This kind of thing, that showing yourself as the sort of the humble, befuddled figure who is narrating this story, does this perhaps lessen any kind of blows you offer towards other figures like this?
Well, there might be something tactical about it, although it's not as calculated as that. The persona is real. You know, it's not... I'm not faking it when I feel overwhelmed or scared or tremulous or out of my depth. That is kind of frequently the way I feel, especially on a story. I find reporting a story tremendously difficult and tremendously lonely work. And I'm essentially shy, which is not a great way to be as a reporter. On those rare occasions when I've actually been on a story, a print story, with the photographer at the same time, I am astonished every single time by the courage of a photojournalist. And these are not stories, you know, we're not in war zones, you know. I went to an Appalachian folk art school down in North Carolina where I learned basket weaving, as evidence there. And it was nice, but I wasn't uncovering like a town that was, you know, being poisoned by the local, you know, mill. But I'm shy. I don't, you know, it's hard for me to sort of approach people. And this photographer just was like, hi, can I take your picture? What are you doing there? Great. Thank you. Can I get you to do it again? You know, and that to me was just extraordinary that she was able to ask people to not just impinge upon their time, but to make them do it again, you know, yeah. Because she didn't get the shot she wanted. And, you know, they did it. They did it again. I'm not built that way. I'm just not good that way.
But maybe writers and journalists don't do this. You have to go ahead and recover something. You only have one shot.
I have only
Unless,
one
of course,
shot.
You've got a tape recorder and you're manically recording everything.
That's
exactly it. You have to get the quote right. You have to get the incident right. You have to get the details right.
Sure. But yeah, but I find it tremendously difficult just to even approach people. I find it hard.
Is this why you often dwell upon decor in your essays? In fact, one thing I wanted to ask in relation to this is that there are a couple of instances. Two things strike me. You're very fond of comparing something to Helmut Newton, and you're very fond of comparing to 1950s science fiction films.
Do I? Oh, shit. That means that I've overused something. I try to be so...
Oh, no, I don't mind it
being overused. No, I know, but I try to be so... You know, I try to be vigilant about not overusing words, not overusing references. Fuck.
You're beating yourself up way too much for this, you know?
Oh, no, because we all... No, because, no, but what it means, what it means is that I'm a hack.
No.
It's okay. I am kind of a hack.
Look,
visual stuff... Well, look, visual stuff is very potent. It's very potent to me. I think it's very important in writing. If you can try and put someone there, that seems important. Decor, I wouldn't call it so much decor as interiors, like the telling details. I don't care if someone has an Aubusson rug, and I don't care if, you know, the sofas clash kind of thing. That I can't feign interest in. But interiors seem kind of important. You have to situate yourself. You have to situate yourself in something. I wish I were sort of smarter and had more just raw data at my fingertips, the way Joan Didion can say, you know, hard by a basin of mountains with, you know, the weak winter sunlight that makes the lettuce grow, you know, or something. I think she wrote that in a piece that I recently read, and it's like, that's smart. That's like, she knows about crops. That's kind of cool.
Well, you have a lot of knowledge.
Yeah, sure. But it's...
And you can only write as true as you can to your voice.
Well, exactly.
You know?
But it's like, wow, how does she know about the lettuce? That really struck me. It's like, that's good. Wait, how did we get on decor?
Well, we were talking about how there are... You often dwell upon environments and interiors... And I was asking, suggesting
that's
this is a way
that's
to deflect.
A way not having to talk to people. Yeah. Certainly. That's probably entirely true. It does help. Because a lot of time when I'm reporting a story, I'm just standing there quietly, scribbling, hoping that... Aren't there entire species of fish that spend their entire time on the ocean floor with like one long tendril that extends from their nose that looks like a floating leaf?
I suspect you know more than me.
And then when like some fish comes by and is like, hey, look, leaf. And then they open their mouth and they eat it.
Yeah.
That's frequently when I'm reporting, I will stand there with my notebook hoping to be essentially like Bugs Bunny when he puts the lampshade on his head and they just run by him thinking, oh, look, a lamp.
You're fond of Bugs Bunny. You actually refer to him in the start of one of the essays.
Bugs Bunny comes in a rather perverse way. Well, yeah, Bugs Bunny was a total cross-dresser with a Litvak sense of humor. I sort of liked old Bugs Bunny. But
he's also the guy who could dispel people by just essentially being a smartass.
Yes. Yes,
that's the lesson I learned from Bugs Bunny. Anyway.
Yes, precisely. You could
don't let someone like get you down. Just respond with a smart-ass remark.
Exactly, and then kiss them on the lips and then leave, then run as fast as you can. But it's, so much of my reporting is just standing there with the notebook, sort of taking notes, taking in the environment, and then hoping that you'll eavesdrop on something good. Like recently, I went to do a story about Utah, and I went to Salt Lake City for a week. And I don't think I have a story there because everything is so wide and so spread out that I really couldn't get close enough to people to eavesdrop, to even approach any kind of audible proximity to someone would seem really unbalanced behavior in Salt Lake City. It's like being in a crowd in an empty movie theater and sitting next to the only other person who's there. It would be like, what are you doing? Get away from me. So that was problematic. That was rather difficult. But yes, I think that's pretty astute of you. I never thought of it that way. But yes, it's absolutely... true.
It's funny you mentioned theaters. I was going to ask you, is this why you attended Puppetry of the Penis Alone? Or
I couldn't get anyone to go with me to puppetry with penis. But also, I generally try to do things alone when I'm reporting them, because company is lovely, but company is death to work. If I'm having to converse with somebody, I'm not taking notes. And I don't want to ignore someone, you know, if I've brought someone along, or if I'm going to something with someone, I'm doing it, you know.
Well, I don't know about that. Maybe is this a sort of, you perhaps fear that you will be so taken in your attentions towards another person that you will actually not focus on the thing, or something might actually not interest you or bore you in a manner that you'll sort of cling to your companion in desperation?
Yes, exactly. That kind of thing. It's different. It's different. Like in Utah, for example, I had a friend and we were driving around, thank God, because I don't drive, and so he really earned his weight in gold. I mean, it was just astonishing how much he helped me. But we went to this haunted house. You know, it was Halloween time. Went to one of these haunted houses where I had gotten permission to go and interview them before it happened. We got there and I found the whole thing so dispiriting and so menacing. I had been sort of expecting the Salt Lake City actor community. I was like, well, I just did Les Mis and Cats is about to come in, and so I'm doing this haunted house, and, you know, I'm trained in voice. But it wasn't. What it was basically every nascent Judas Priest suicide pact maker in town in his Hot Topic black punk trousers with the built-in suspenders that hang to the ankles, and a cheap black t-shirt, and maybe a cheap black acetate cape, and fake contact lenses, and faces that are just constellations of acne, you know, just kids who are in despair, you know, in that kind of goth despair. And it's this plywood labyrinth where if you wanted to kill someone, you might as well go there, because you could just kill them and no one would ever find them until the next day. And this band called Rammstein,
oh yeah, I know,
okay,
them.
Is like blaring Du Hast Mich. You know, and it's like, I don't really respond well to bombastic German music and a kind of concentration camp aesthetic. I was really uncomfortable, really menaced. And had I been there alone, without transport, I would have stayed. And I would have done my interviews and I would have taken it in. But because I was there with my friend Wyatt, I was like, I can't do this. Let's go. I'll pay for your dinner, but let's go.
I'm also curious that if your friend had not been there, would you have had these judgments? Because
I would have been terrified.
Well, no, but what I mean is maybe there's another side to this story. Maybe these kids aren't just sort of, I mean, you're drawing a broad brush for a whole group of people. Maybe there are a few who
undoubtedly
happen to be confused kids or something.
Undoubtedly. Absolutely. They were all confused kids. Not one of them was a bad person, I'm sure. I completely succumbed to my own fears and my own neuroses and my own feelings in that moment. I had an escape route, and I did what I generally try not to do as a journalist, which is that I left before I could spend longer than 20 minutes somewhere and find the story. But I was too scared. I was too upset.
What do you do to conquer these fears?
I mean, well, generally I'm trapped. Generally I don't, you know, what do I do? I generally don't have a means of transportation, or generally I'm too worried about not doing a good job. And generally I'm worried about having been a very phobic child, like a very phobic child, scared of everything. And I'm still pretty well scared of everything, as I said. But I was educated early on about the fact that if you give in to your fears, they will rule your life and they will ruin your life. And so much of what I've done in my life has been a counterphobic experiment. Although moving to New York wasn't scary to me. Moving to New York at age 17 was just, I came alive. It was like stepping into a warm bath. It was utterly easy and felt natural, more natural than anything I've ever done. But for the most part, everything is a counterphobic experiment. Everything is sort of an exercise in steeling myself and doing it anyway. And so generally, when I'm reporting a story, it's that. It's just being like, this scares you? Then you must do it. I don't do stupid shit, although I have done some stupid shit. But I generally don't do that. I'm generally secure enough in my masculinity. I don't get emasculated easy. Like the old terms of like, oh, little baby faggot. Like, I don't actually care. I'm, you know, that doesn't cut a lot of ice with me. So I don't do that sort of stuff just to do it. But yeah, it's because Wyatt was there and because I had an escape, I perhaps didn't honor the situation. But I was so... There was something about it that just got me on this primal level where it was like, I have to get out of here. I was so menaced and I was so scared in this really weird way. I've still not sufficiently digested it, and I know that there are some articulate paragraphs in my brain that could come out about it, and I cannot describe them well enough, and I can't do it well enough.
If you can confess to me in words, in conversation, about how frightened you were, can you confess to this to a computer? To
oh, that I can do, but I that's what feels like a failure to me is that I've been insufficiently articulate about it, about why and what's going on.
Gotcha. If you were a journalist in the present, what of these past pieces? Is that journalism, or is that a way for you to sort of figure out how things fit together? I mean, for example, writing about working on this Marxist camp and the like, in which you have this stunning realization that you prefer men to chickens.
Yes.
One of the questions I was going to ask you is whether, you know, you must labor as a kid to figure out what biological things you like. And
actually, that's the one, you know, someone has once, I frequently get asked, like, is it all true? Is everything you write true? Everything I write is true. And I think it sadly shows in my book sales, you know, because I do okay, but I'm by no means a blockbuster bestseller. Everything I say is true. Everything happened. There are only two things that semi didn't happen. In one piece, I gave a joke that I used to tell to another person as a means of, you know, and then another brilliant bon mot from my lips, you know, I gave it to another person so that it was, you know, the joke could get told and it didn't seem self-aggrandizing. The other thing is in that chicken story where the revelation is I suddenly realize I don't like chickens, I like men. That's not entirely honest. I knew a long time before. I knew at age like 3.
Yeah.
That was never a problem for me.
Well, then where, under what circumstances can you justify a narrative liberty like this then?
I don't know. I mean, I did it, so I obviously justified it to myself. But
did it need to end, or what was the situation with the chicken men thing?
It needed, it's only 50% not true, in that it's not like I suddenly arrived at the conclusion that I like men in that moment. Although I did arrive at the conclusion in that moment that masculinity framed in a certain way held not just no attraction to me, but was by no means intrinsically better than what I knew my life to be and what my life was going to be. And in that sense, it's 100% true. It's like, you know, this is not the referendum on who and what I am and whether I'm going to be a worthwhile person and whether I'm even going to be a man.
Yeah.
My Y chromosome is as indisputable as anybody in this chicken coop, but I still choose not to do what you're asking of me.
Yeah.
So in that sense, the revelation in that moment was 100% true.
The other revelation I want to ask you about is your American citizen status, which explored in each book in different manners. You kvetch about waiting 4 weeks to get your extraordinary alien status, but try
do
doing
I
that after.
About it?
Yeah, but try doing that after September 11th.
Oh,
and,
I know.
You wouldn't get that kind of turnaround time. And then you have...
Wait, surely I even mentioned that it's astonishing that I get it in 4 weeks. Do I think about it being a long waiting time?
I think you do. I'm
surely
gonna have
to, not.
We could dredge up the book.
Let's. Here. We have to return to the text because I feel convinced that I would never kvetch about something
like
that.
Well, I mentioned this because my girlfriend actually is also an alien of extraordinary abilities as
Where's
well.
Where's she from?
She's from Ottawa.
Oh.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So, but...
But
I mean, I wasn't necessarily referring to that, but I wanted to ask you about why did you re-explore this thing. I don't think it was entirely about becoming an American citizen. I almost feel that, I mean, one book is written before September 11th, and one book is written after September 11th.
Huh.
And I was wondering if you felt a need to return to this notion of being a sort of émigré from Toronto in a manner that was more fitting of the contemporary times. Or am I reading too much significance into this? And maybe we can extend this into the general timbre of both collections, because it's interesting to read one against the other. One is more concerned with, you know, the first one is seems to me more concerned with relating many past incidences of yourself, and the second one, oddly enough, seems more concerned with quibbling over things like sea salt and also just sort of taking war with the pedantic or the needlessly pedantic in our societies.
The needlessly pedantic or the needlessly...
Well, the needlessly... People placing significance on the needlessly pedantic, to be clear on that.
Well, it's certainly... I mean, the second one... The second book is, you know, a little bit of a screed against the culture of entitlement and excess and how much we have. It even ends with, you know, the final piece in the book is deals with the final frontier, which is death, and the cryonicists who want to freeze themselves and then come back to life. And essentially, I even ask, you know, why are we coming away from the table, which has been laden with, you know, plenty, never seen before in history, and why are we still leaving the table so hungry all the time? When is it going to be enough for people? And, you know, having become an American citizen in 2003, specifically to vote, to entrench my relationship with New York City, which is the great love of my life, and which is my home and has been my home for a quarter of a century and longer than I've lived anywhere else, but also to sort of establish a kind of bona fides with what I was about to say in terms of we all have too much and everybody's just got to shut the fuck up and stop being such an entitled baby about stuff. It seemed important for me to say, I'm one of you. I've been one of you for two decades, but now even on paper, I'm one of you, like every immigrant who came before me. Did September 11th have anything to do with it? Well, not by coincidence. September 11th gave way to the Patriot Act, which gave way to what I felt was a somewhat more precarious way of being here, even though I'm a well-educated white Canadian guy.
But it also spawned your citizenship, too.
That's why. I mean, that's and because of that, I just didn't feel safe anymore. I felt like, no, this is not... You know, this is no longer the New York that I know and love, and I don't want to be thrown out for whatever reason. I don't know why I wouldn't be thrown out, but never say never.
Rooting yourself, perhaps.
What?
Rooting yourself.
Rooting myself? Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. And as I said, as a way of establishing some bona fides that I was allowed to say these things. You know, I think in certain ways, almost everything I write is, on some level, covertly or overtly, a kind of love letter to New York City. I don't know if I'm fooling myself, but I think that might be true.
Another situation where you're dwelling upon environment. Maybe this is your exterior, New York City.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it really is just sort of I give it too much credit, and of course, lately it's been breaking my heart because it's become a completely less interesting place to live, and that, I think, is progressing, and I don't see how we can ever go back at this point, given the fact that you can't be a young person and move here to make art, you can't be a school teacher and live here, you can't be a nurse, you can't be a fireman, you know, it's just become a city of the very, very rich. And the chain store, and that's, I mean, I'm hardly saying anything revolutionary or incendiary or terribly original. But, so I guess I sort of visited it twice because in the first book is having gotten my green card, and the second book is having become a citizen. It seemed sort of, I don't know, maybe I'm overly invested in establishing my my legitimacy as a New Yorker. Maybe I'm, and I know that I'm overly invested in that. But I don't know. I don't know where I've gone with this.
Maybe it's a legitimacy as there's a legitimacy being an American citizen, perhaps shared with a legitimacy being a writer, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. And that still seems, well, both still seem up for grabs. Or rather, the jury seems out on both of those. Legitimacy of being a New Yorker, that I don't, that's the one thing where I don't feel like a fraud, which is interesting. I feel completely.
You really feel that you are a fraud?
Sure, but I think everybody does on some level.
I don't know, because I mean, I read fraud and I'm thinking to myself, this isn't a particular case of someone being a fraud. This is simply a person who wants to communicate their fears, their emotions, their feelings, trying to sort of wrestle with past incidents. That's not being a fraud. That's just trying to come to terms with the great unknown.
Sure, but feeling on some level that you're taking people in, that people have been taken in when they respond positively, that you've somehow managed to seduce them in some way or trick them, that's an ever-present fear. That sort of never goes away.
It's odd because this is not really voiced as much in the books as it is in this conversation, this
That's
idea
interesting.
Of really stringing someone along. I don't view any of your essays as being particularly mean-spirited. If anything...
No, not mean-spirited. I mean in terms of when people respond positively to the work.
Okay.
There is a sense and a feeling that, like, well, if they really knew.
Okay.
That kind of stuff.
That's what you mean by fraud. That if people respond positively to what you do, you don't believe them?
I feel a little bad for them for having drunk my Kool-Aid. That somehow that I've managed to trick them.
So you're suggesting that your feelings aren't valid?
No, that my feelings are valid, but that what I've put forward is a trick, that I've somehow managed to seduce them or divert their attention away from whatever matter at hand, and the essential truth being that, you know, I'm either bad or I'm not all that, or I am fraudulent. But I think that this is many people who are creative types. I think it's the case of many performers, you know.
I mean, I thought the Edlinger photo was a bit of a fraud in the first one.
That's interesting.
That to me is the most fraudulent part of the book, really, to
me. That's very interesting. Well, that you know, it's interesting. The Marion Edlinger photo, you know, having worked in publishing, it was a dream. You know, it was a dream come true when I was like an editorial assistant to do it. And I really love Marion, and she's actually a friend. But in retrospect, and I, as you see, I did not go back to Marion for the second book. Because precisely what you're saying, I realized that in fact a kind of, not airbrushed, but somewhat manipulated and idealized version of myself was in fact the opposite of what I was trying to say.
Yeah. Well, also the poses that Edlinger uses, it's always that strange sort of pose where it looks like every subject has an arm length that's literally three times as long as it really is.
Yeah, they define mannerism. It's absolutely true. And it's and it seemed at that time in my life, it seemed sort of like a dream come true.
But it was kind of fun. Yeah, I mean, it's clearly sure. It was, you know.
But in retrospect, yeah, I've never used the photo ever again, and I've been highly resistant to it because it does have, when I see it now, especially given the fact that I've aged fairly significantly, I think, and I've lost, you know, a good amount of hair since then, the words, "Who does he think he's kidding?" certainly ring in my head. But it doesn't take much to make those words ring in my head. But as you'll see, the author photo in the second book is decidedly more verite.
Yeah.
Much to my chagrin, you know. But one can't be, there's even a piece in the book about, you know, seeking the physical ideal and going to talk to these plastic surgeons.
Yeah.
And recognizing that, you know, this is what one is in life. But in terms of fraudulence, feeling fraudulent, I mean, I've hardly cornered the market on that.
But okay, I'll ask you one last question, and it's kind of pertaining to this question. But for example, there are two instances in these essays. One in which you go to this survival camp, and one in which you climb the mountain, in which you obtain sort of plastic shoes.
Yes.
In both cases. And I'm wondering about this. This seems to me almost as
if... No, they're not plastic shoes in the second one. They're just black.
Oh, okay. I mean, they're like cheap shoes. They're not exactly professional gear, in other words.
No, in the second one, they're probably nice, but it's the color that people react to.
Ah, okay.
It's because everybody has brown shoes.
Okay. I just wanted to ask you about this notion of being an inveterate urbanite. Mm. How this often affects these peregrinations into the wild.
Sure.
And that this kind of gives you this conceptual construct with which to basically throw a canvas upon.
Yes, but it's a construct I've never returned to.
Yeah.
This is the thing. You can only be a fish. I've said this before too. You can only be a fish out of water 3 times, and then you're just an amphibian. Then you can only get drunk and sleep with the football team 3 times before you're just the school whore. So I have in fact not returned to the outdoors. I mean, I've returned to the outdoors on stories, but certainly I've never gone back to the well of not liking the outdoors. I don't like the outdoors any more than I used to. I'm certainly no more comfortable in the outdoors than I used to. Although I've been in the outdoors more than almost any New Yorker that I know. Even though I hate the outdoors almost more than any New Yorker that I know. But I've certainly never gone back to that well in terms of writing about that stuff. Because you really can't, because then the unseen, the unseen voice in me yells, then stay the fuck home. Why would anyone want to hear about you not liking the outdoors anymore? But I am. I'm a city person. I 2 summers ago, I went on a travel story to Eastern Canada, where I met my best friend and her kids, and we traveled around. And they were on their holiday, their family holiday, and these are my godchildren. And I was on a travel story. And we were in the wilderness, at a hotel, so it wasn't like we were camping. We were in the wilderness. It was lovely and everything. We're driving along and everything, and her husband, my other friend, is driving, thank God, because I can't drive. But when we get to Halifax, which is a city... I open like a flower. I mean, I come right down. It's not some posture on my part. I just feel better with the density of people, with buildings, with streets, with infrastructure. I'm just better. I'm not immune to the beauties of nature. I mean, Western Canada, where I went on another travel story, remains the most beautiful place I've ever been in my life. And 4.5 years later, I'm still feeling the salubrious effects of having kayaked every day for a week. Mm-hmm. I'm not... But this is where I feel most at home, in a city, navigating streets and traffic and all that. The sort of posture of the urbanite... adrift in the wilderness has never been returned to. It's still very much my thing, the truth of my life. I don't, when people invite me out to the country, I generally just simply politely decline, tell them that it's very sweet of them to invite me, but I'll probably never come. I don't misrepresent myself in that way, but I also don't. The reason that I am not a memoirist, and what I try to remain vigilant about all the time, is I don't want to calcify into some caricatured Gorgon version of myself. I don't want to mythologize my foibles, and I don't want to sort of find that I can't take that mask off. I try to stay hip to myself. So, in fact, I don't write anymore about having been a secretary in publishing, because that's not the reality of my life anymore. I've crossed the parliament floor, and I am now one of, the privileged few. And I try to stay very mindful of that. I don't want to talk about, the teeny bedroom I lived in Brooklyn. Although I do in a story that I've just written, but only insofar as it's a part of my past.
Hmm. Was that a fiction story?
Or No. It's a nonfiction.
Have you actually attempted to write fiction? Or?
I tried. I actually published one story in one of those gay anthologies many, many years ago. I'd love to try and write fiction because I even though I don't read a lot of fiction, the novel remains that sort of holy grail for a writer. And also it, as I've indicated... If you find reporting difficult, if you find it sort of a challenge to go out on the road and sort of hard to talk to people and it would be nice to be able to stay in like a Bronte sister and make stuff up and do it well enough that one was diverted for oneself and derive pleasure from the doing of it, and that people would want to read it.
Well, there's also this aspect, too. You can write things in fiction that you don't feel comfortable writing in nonfiction.
Well, that's a good idea.
George Saunders, in fact, said that he preserves more of his mean-spirited kind of ideas that he puts into his fiction. He doesn't like doing that for nonfiction.
No, that's probably true, but George Saunders is a genius. Geniuses make poor examples for the rest of us.
Oh, I don't know. We could at least try, I suppose.
True.
Well, David, thanks so much for talking with you.
Thank you very much. Likewise. Thanks. You should eat more of the cookies.
Great.